sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On February 24, 2014, WWUH and the Connecticut 9/11 Truth Group will be showing the film Waiting for Mercy about the FBI entrapment of innocent Muslims, in this case, from Albany, New York. It's quite shocking to see what's being done. Today you'll hear the replay of an interview that I did in January of 2011 with Stephen Downs, who was one of the lawyers for the defendants in the film Waiting for Mercy. In the interview, you'll hear the updated date for the film, which is February 24th. Also, attorney Stephen Downs will be joining us on February 24th to lead a discussion following the film. And again, that will be on Monday, February 24th at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. And now here's the interview with attorney Stephen Downs. Last July, when I was at the anti-war conference in Albany, I learned about the many Muslims who are serving long jail sentences after being entrapped by the FBI. There are two men in the Albany area, including the imam of the local mosque, who are serving 15 years in jail after being entrapped this way. The people in the Albany area were so outraged by these arrests and convictions through entrapment and questionable legal practices that a book was written about the cases called Rounded Up, Artificial Terrorists and Muslim Entrapment After 9/11, and it was written by Shamshad Ahmad, who is a physics professor at the University of Albany, SUNY, and a movie was also made about the entrapment and trials called Waiting for Mercy, the case against Yasin Aref and Mohammed Hossein, which was produced by Ellie Bernstein. Today on the show, I'll be interviewing Stephen Downs, who was one of the lawyers for Yasin Aref, the imam from the local Albany mosque. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad you had me on.
I understand that you became involved with the case of the USA versus Yasin Aref back in 2006, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the case and why you decided to volunteer your time to help defend the alleged terrorist, Yasin Aref.
Well, I heard about the case in the paper, and I talked to the lawyer involved who had been appointed by the court, and the case just didn't sound right to me. There sounded something wrong with it. So I volunteered my service because at that point I was retired. I didn't have anything else to do. It soon became apparent to me that what the government had done was decide that for some reason, based on some sort of secret information that we were not allowed to see, they thought Yasin was some kind of a security risk. And so they brought essentially fake charges against him. They cooked up a sting and then involved him in it, but didn't give him enough information for him to understand that there was anything illegal going on in what he was doing. All he was doing was gratuitously witnessing alone. And, of course, there's nothing illegal about that, unless you happen to know that there's something wrong with a loan. But they never gave him enough information for him to understand that. Unfortunately, the government confused the evidence to such an extent that the jury, although throwing out most of the charges, convicted him of one small set of charges, and so he ended up getting sentenced to 15 years in jail. And so that was essentially what the case was about.
And I understand from reading the book Roundup, Artificial Terrorists and Muslim Entrapment After 9/11, that in the Muslim culture, they don't believe in paying interest, so they often make loans amongst themselves, and then they have a third party witness it.
That's right. That's very common, that in order to keep your money moving, you make loans to friends without interest, and it's required under the Quran to have it witnessed by someone, and the imam is typically the person who does the witnessing. So the FBI set up the sting in a very, very clever way that he would not realize that he was doing anything wrong and, in fact, would have thought that he was doing exactly what he was supposed to do as an imam.
And there were two people arrested in this. There was Yasin Aref and then there was Mohammed Hossein.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the case and what they were doing?
Right. Well, the government wanted to use someone else. They needed a third party because under the law they couldn't have a conspiracy between Yassin and the government informant. There had to be a third party involved. So they picked some poor guy out of the mosque that was part of the mosque that Yassin was the imam of, and they essentially targeted him, went after him, as a way to get to Yassin. They went to him and they said, look, the government informant, this guy we called Malik, he was named Malik at the trial, went to him and said, you are my dear friend, my dear brother, I love you so much, I want to make a loan to you so that you can fix up your apartments and your rental properties and so on. And then after he'd got him really hooked very well, then he began to drop hints that this money came from the sale of a missile that was going to be used in some sort of a plot. The government didn't care about Hussein particularly. They were just using him as a patsy. What they wanted to do was to get him to then go to Yassin Aref, because he was the guy they were really concerned about. As it turned out, they had virtually no evidence during the trial that anybody had ever told Yassin anything. And I'll just give you one example of the kind of things that they pulled. Yassin was convicted only of the last conversation that had between the three of them. And in that last conversation, the government informant talked about buying and selling missiles and making money and doing other things using a code word in which the word Chowdhury was substituted for the word missile. So he would say, I buy and sell Chowdhuries, I get money for them, I can make you a loan, and so on and so forth. If you knew what the word Chowdhury meant, then the conversation would have been rather incriminating. It would have suggested that the loan was, in fact, a bad loan. But if you didn't know what the word meant, it would mean absolutely nothing, particularly to someone like Yassin Aref, who knew very little English at the time and obviously thought that Chowdhury was something that was harmless. The government never established at trial that Yassin had ever been told the code word. This was an absolutely crucial point, and yet, unfortunately, because of all of the confusion, I think the jury missed that crucial point. The government actually lied about it and said he had been told, but then never introduced any evidence to show that that was the case. And so that's what he got convicted for. But that was how cleverly they manipulated the evidence. And it was, to me, it was appeared clearly to be a frame-up, a setup. They set this thing whole up in order to get him.
And why were they looking at him in particular? Do you know that?
We don't know. It's secret. One of the things that happened very early on was that the government said that he was dangerous because he was a commander of terrorists. And they based that on the fact that they had gotten a notebook in northern Iraq in some sort of a battle that had gone on there, and they picked this notebook up off the battlefield. And in it was Yassin's name, and they said there was the word commander was next to it. Now, we asked for the page. There was a big fight about it. The government didn't want to disclose it, but eventually they disclosed it. And the government suddenly acknowledged that they had mistranslated the word. It didn't mean commander at all. It simply meant brother, and was used in the typical form of a mister. It was just simply a sign of respect. After that, the government clamped down on everything. They just said everything was classified. We weren't allowed to see it. So we never knew, and they began to give a lot of information, secret information, to the judge in the case. We would get large briefs in which everything had been redacted except the opening sentence and the closing sentence.
Wow. Now, as an attorney, and you've practiced law for many years, what's happened to our legal system since 9/11 that our government can entrap these people and do this and then have the evidence be classified and so there's no way to rebut what they're saying?
Well, it's been completely skewed. I've never seen anything like it. I would not have believed these kind of things would have been possible. What seems to have happened, my interpretation at least, is that the government has gone to the courts and said, in effect, this is a highly asymmetric war we're fighting against terrorists. We believe that there may be people who would cooperate with terrorists in this country. And in order to fight that, we have to fight this in our own way. We cannot go through the normal procedure. So we're going to go through a fake court proceeding. But we need this outcome because we regard these as potentially enemy soldiers that we have to get rid of. And somehow the courts are going along with this. This was certainly the feel that I had in my case. I've heard of hundreds of such cases all across the country in which people who have gone through these cases have said, I can't believe what happened. There was no evidence. I don't know why my husband, my son, has been locked up for 30 years or for life.
It's just astounding, really.
It is. And you talk to legal scholars, and they all kind of scratch their heads about it. They all have theories. They're all upset about it. They see the erosion of all of our constitutional liberties But because so much of what is being done is secret, it is very hard to confront it directly. You cannot say, you have this particular doctrine and we want to challenge it. We don't know what the doctrine is. We don't know on what basis they're doing it.
Are there any groups of lawyers trying to get at this and to...
Yes. On the basis of this case, the people in Albany were really upset about it. We had 50 people came together, and we felt that our first duty was to take care of the families of the men that were convicted. And we've tried to do that. We've raised a lot of money, and we've tried to support them. They have a total of 10 kids, and in at least one of the families has no support, no income at all, no source of income whatsoever. So that has been one of our focuses. But also reached out to other groups that have had the same kind of problems, and we found language to talk about. We describe this process as preemptive prosecution. That is, where the government prosecutes people for crimes that they didn't commit in order to prevent them maybe from committing some sort of a crime in the future. If you describe it that way, it sounds completely bizarre. You would say, well, how can you be convicted of a crime that you didn't commit to prevent you from committing a crime in the future? It sounds like sort of the pre-crime department.
Yeah.
But in fact, that's what they seem to be doing. And so by doing that, we've formed a group called Project Salaam, which is trying to raise awareness of this. And Project Salaam has just recently become part of the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms, which is a larger umbrella organization that is bringing a lot of civil rights organizations into this fight. It's a very difficult issue because so little is publicly known about it. So much of it is kept classified.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty scary to me. And I just wanted to jump back into this guy Malik, who was the FBI informant. I understand from reading the book Roundup that he also went to Newburgh, New York, and trapped some people there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Malik is a very, very interesting character. He's a brilliant con man, a criminal on many levels. He was apparently had to leave Pakistan because he was wanted for murder over there. He came to this country, got a job in the Department of Motor Vehicles, and promptly engaged in a whole series of frauds to get driver's licenses for people who couldn't pass the test. He would essentially give them the right answers while translating the test for them. Eventually, he was caught. He was convicted of a lot of felonies, and he promptly turned around and said that he would help the FBI. The FBI then used him to set up this sting to catch Yasin Arif. And after that was over, they had nothing much else to do with him, but they couldn't cut him loose. He's a very dangerous individual. So eventually they sent him down to Newburgh and asked him to hang out in a parking lot and see how many outside the mosque and see if he could entrap some people down there. The mosque got on to him right away. They immediately sensed that there's something wrong with this guy. But he did find one person down there who was kind of a braggart and a loser and a person without any resources at all, who he talked into joining in some sort of a scheme to blow up a mosque and shoot some planes down at an airfield. The question really, of course, in that case is who was conning who? The sense was that James Cromarty, the guy that he was talking to, was actually trying to con Malik into giving him a lot of money, which he was going to run off with, whereas Malik was trying to con this guy into getting him a conviction. They then got two or three other people who were supposed to be part of this plot, although none of them had any driver's licenses. They had no money. They had no expertise. They didn't know anything about Islam. They didn't know the targets. All of this had to be picked by the FBI. It all had to be hand-given to them. Even then, they didn't want to do it. Finally, Malik persuaded them to do it, essentially by saying that his life was on the line. If he didn't get this thing done, bad guys were going to come and kill him, and so they had to do it. So the whole thing was probably the worst entrapment scheme that I have ever seen, in which they really put tremendous pressure on these four guys to do this attack on the synagogue. Unfortunately, the jury didn't buy the entrapment scheme and convicted the four men, so now they're facing sentencing.
Wow. Now, Hussein and Arif had, what, 15 years each in jail they got for this?
They each got 15 years, yes.
Is there any appeal left, or is their appeal process done?
The appeal process has expired. I have to say, just as an example of the kind of justice we're facing here, when we appealed to the Second Circuit, we put in our brief, and the government put in its brief, and then the government filed a secret brief, which only the court was allowed to see, and Then they filed a top-secret brief, which even the local prosecutor wasn't allowed to see. Then we went down and we had an argument before the court, and then we were excused, and the government got to argue secretly before the court.
Wow.
So, and the decision basically came out, it just neglected all of the points that we had raised, didn't say anything about them or mischaracterized them. And it was a decision unlike any I think I've seen that seemed to just disregard all the important constitutional issues.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like our Constitution has just been thrown out the window.
Yeah, it does. It seems that way. And that's what you hear over and over again from legal scholars who say, we don't understand what's going on. Something is going on behind the scenes here, but it's secret and we don't know.
And you said they are challenging this through this national coalition?
Coalition.
Okay.
Yes. We're going to mount a campaign to try to do something about it and to get legislation passed. One of the worst things that happened recently was the Supreme Court decided the Humanitarian Law Project, which criminalizes essentially free speech. This is where if you say anything to a designated foreign terrorist organization, positive, or help them in any way, you can be convicted of material support for terrorism. Now, just by saying it, that it doesn't sound that bad. You'd say, well, why would you cooperate with a designated foreign terrorist organization? Until you realize that a lot of these organizations are, in many other respects, completely legitimate organizations. For example, Hamas is the duly elected government of at least part of Palestine.
Right.
They build roads, they build schools, they do hospitals, they feed the poor, they do all sorts of things. Can you cooperate with Hamas to feed destitute children, for example? The Humanitarian Law Project case says no. If you try to do that, you are nonetheless engaged in material support for a designated terrorist organization, you can go to jail for life.
And I understand even if you donate money to an organization and you don't know that they might be connected to, quote, supposed terrorists, that you can also be put away even though you had no idea.
Yes, the government has taken that position. I'm not sure whether average Americans need to be worried about it, but certainly anyone that would have knowledge of the fact that the organization was a designated terrorist organization should be worried. Yeah, anything that goes to them, even if it is nonviolent, even if it is support nonviolent activities, peaceful activities, should be worried. And in fact, now they're not necessarily going after Muslims about it. They're going after peace activists who meet with groups who are essentially the de facto government in particular areas of countries.
Right.
And meet with them to try to work out peaceful solutions to the conflicts there are now being charged by the government with material support for terrorism.
That's those FBI raids out in the Chicago area back in September.
Same tactics are being used against Bradley Manning and the WikiLeaks people. Bradley Manning is now in deep solitary confinement. He's being treated like the Muslim defendants who, as soon as they're arrested, are put in solitary confinement. They're not allowed to talk to anybody, sometimes for years at a time, although it is recognized that solitary confinement under those kind of conditions amounts to torture. And we're torturing them regularly in this country, in Manhattan, in New York, in all over the country.
That's shocking.
Yeah.
So Hussein and Arif, I understand, were at first jailed around the Albany area in New York, and then I understand they've been moved like out to the Midwest somewhere?
Right. The government has set up something called CMUs, Communication Management Units. And these units are essentially Muslim prisons for terrorists. They always keep a token non-Muslim there just so they can say it's not the case. But in fact, that's where all of these defendants seem to end up. And the point of the Communication Management Unit is to keep these people isolated from the regular prison population and from the general public. I don't believe any journalist has ever had a chance to interview any of them. They're only allowed one 15-minute phone call a week to their families. And the families can only visit under very limited conditions. They can't, for example, have contact visits with their families. It all has to be behind a plate glass window with a telephone. So on a couple of occasions, I brought Yassin's children out to see him in the communication management unit out in Terre Haute. And in each case, the kids were only allowed to see him through a plate glass window and talk to him on a telephone.
Wow.
Now, this is very unusual, and of course, the time is very limited.
Yeah, and it's very costly to go out there and all of that.
It took 2 days to drive them out. We had 1 day in the prison, 2 days to drive back, so that's a 5-day trip for at best a couple of hours.
Yeah.
And then they threw us out early because I took out a pen, and they said that I had an illegal recording device with me and threw me out.
You're kidding. Wow. So now let me ask you this. These preemptive prosecutions started under the Bush administration after 9/11.
Yes.
Has anything changed under the Obama administration?
No, not at all. In fact, if anything, they've probably gotten worse. We have gotten no relief. I've written many letters to Obama and to Holder. Other organizations have also. The only thing I ever get from Obama, and I got again this year, was a Christmas card wishing me peace on Earth. But other than that, I've gotten nothing.
Well, isn't that an irony? Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Well, so where can somebody go if they want to get more information about Aref's case or Hussein's case?
Well, Project Salaam has a website, projectsalaam.org, just S-A-L-A-M, projectsalaam.org, which we have some information there, and that's linked to a special website that has information about Yassin's case. Yassin, of course, he's a brilliant man. He's one of the deepest people that I've ever met. He struggled a little bit with English when I started, but he ended up, between the time he was convicted and the time he sentenced, he wrote a book about his life. It was really quite an extraordinary feat. He wrote it out all longhand, and it was typed up. It's since been published, and it's a wonderful book.
What's the name of it?
Son of Mountains.
Okay.
It's an absolutely fascinating book about his life in Kurdistan, where he grew up. And a lot of my knowledge about the Middle East I bring from this book, because it is so rich and has so many insights into it. He doesn't talk much about his case because, of course, from his point of view, his case was almost irrelevant. He was just doing a function that you would do as an imam, and he did many, many times on other occasions, and was completely unaware that there was anything illegal about it. So the fact that the FBI one day swooped him up off the street and took him down and chained him to a chair and threatened him all night and yelled at him and then locked him up, it's like bad, but what was it about? And as he writes in his book, he says, I want somebody to go through my trial transcript and tell me what I did that was wrong. If anybody can tell me anything that I did that was wrong, I'll accept it. And I have to say, I've gone through all of this material. He asked me that question frequently, and I have to tell him, Yassin, I've gone through the whole thing. I can't see what on earth you did that was wrong.
Now, you live in the Albany area, I take it, and I'm
yes.
just wondering, what has this whole entrapment scheme done to the Muslim community?
Oh, it's been devastating. I mean, they are really scared. You know, I think most of the people, most of the Muslims came here essentially to escape the chaos in the Middle East. These tend to be professional people or well-educated people. They wanted to build lives here, and I think they really thought that America was something special, that it had a special regard for the law in which everybody was equal before the law. And what they saw was that time after time, the government went after people that were not involved in terrorism in any way and brought these phony charges and were essentially out to get the Muslim community. They are so afraid that they will not come out to rallies. It's hard to get them involved in any of these proceedings because they believe that if they do show up, they will be targeted. And so I think they've all been very relieved to see that there are at least some non-Muslims that are willing to take up the cause and say, wait a minute, what America always was about was equal protection under the law. Everybody's treated equally.
Right, and you know, it starts with the Muslim community, but now we see it's going to the peace activists and
That's
the environmental
right.
activists, so it doesn't stop there.
No.
You know. So we're going to be showing the movie Waiting for Mercy, the case mm-hmm. against Yassin Aref and Mohammed Hussein on
February 24th, 2014.
And hopefully you can bring some of the books with you, Son of Mountains yep. or Roundup, that people could get at the event if they
yes.
wanted to.
Yeah, certainly would be glad to do that.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners that we haven't already discussed about this case or the implications for the broader legal system?
Well, I started, of course, with this case. It upset me very much just from the beginning because I saw an innocent man convicted, deliberately convicted by the government. And the first time you see that, it's really... particularly, I think, as a lawyer, it just really hurts you that a government would do something like that. My next stage was then to go and see hundreds of other cases like that all across the country and realize that this was part of a program by the government to take down innocent people, that it was very similar to what happened at Guantanamo, where they went abroad, they got a group of innocent people over there that were basically sold to them as bounty. they claimed that these were the worst of the worst and put them in a prison in Guantanamo, knowing that most of them were completely innocent, because it was more useful to the government to have a pretend army in Guantanamo than to acknowledge that there were very few of them that had any involvement in terrorism at all. And in the same way, I think, they went and they've locked up hundreds of people in the United States on fake charges for the same reason, because it's more useful to them to have a fake terrorist army that they can constantly point to, rather than to acknowledge that most of these people never had any interest in terrorism at all. So there is a real parallel between what's going on here and what's going on abroad. Then, of course, there is the larger picture of what's happening with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and all of the peace activists that are now being dragged into it. And you see more and more this is becoming a political battle. It starts out as a legal battle, but in the end, we are talking about politics and the use of fear, the political use of fear. And you see it in the right, particularly as they try to use Islamophobia to push their agendas, their fear of foreigners, their must deport people, and so on and so forth. So there's a whole political agenda that is driving this. It is driven by fear, and the people they're locking up are the model for which the fear is drawn. So I'm beginning to realize now that my battle really is not in the courts anymore. It's really more in the political arena. This is not something I'm used to. I've never done this before, but I'm going to have to learn to do it, because that's the only way we're going to get on top of this, I think.
And as long as they have the American public afraid and thinking that there's this whole army of Muslim terrorists out there ready to attack us at any moment, we give up our freedoms willingly. We will go through body scanners, we'll do whatever, you know, we'll allow torture, we'll be quiet about the wars, we'll support them financially. And people are making a lot of money on it.
A lot of money.
Yeah.
Security business is really booming now.
Yeah, it's frightening to me. But anyway, I really want to thank you for being on the show, and I look forward to meeting you or someone else from your community on
February 24th, 2014.
And thank you again for all your efforts in this.
My pleasure, Cheryl. Thank you so much for having me on.
That was Stephen Downs, the attorney for Yasin Aref, the imam who was set up by the FBI and who is now serving 15 years in prison. And the title of the film is Waiting for Mercy: The Case Against Yasin Aref and Mohammed Hussein. And now I want to read to you the famous statement by Pastor Martin Niemöller about the inactivity of German intellectuals following the Nazi rise to power and the purging of their chosen targets group after group. So here goes. They came first for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me, and by that time, no one was left to speak up. Since 9/11, we've been bombarded with two wars, plus some more in the making, torture, secret renditions, anthrax, a series of fake terrorist attacks, the erosion of our civil liberties, financial chaos and bank bailouts, inadequate health care, the horrors of Hurricane Katrina, the BP disaster, the disappointment of Obama, the realization that our corporate media is nothing more than a propaganda machine for the Pentagon, and the list goes on. It's my opinion that much of this is done deliberately to keep us in shock and not knowing which way to turn. My hope for 2011 is that people begin to come out of the shock and denial and begin to take some action, that they pick one area to focus on where they feel they can be most effective. I think it's quite clear now that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans are going to save us. Our system is broken. All we've got left is people power. My hope for 2011 is that we collectively find that power. I have the same hopes for 2014, and I feel very optimistic. So please get involved. If not you, then who? This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.